Thank you so much for tuning in to Let's Talk, the official podcast of the National Runway Safe Line, or NRS. At NRS, we operate the federally designated national communication system for youth who have run away, are experiencing homelessness, or who may be considering leaving home. For over 50 years, we have provided crisis support and resources for young people, families, and communities across the nation. My name is Christopher, and I'm the Director of Marketing and Communications for NRS, and I hope you learn as much as I do on this journey to elevate the voices of young people and youth-facing organizations as they share their stories and highlight the complexities and intersections witnessed by 4.2 million young people facing homelessness each year. This year, as a part of Human Trafficking Prevention Month, Let's Talk is presenting a three-part series on human trafficking. If you haven't already, I highly recommend listening to the previous episode where I had a conversation with Ashley Smith Thompson, a case response specialist with Polaris, about the misconceptions and realities of labor trafficking. For part two, I'm joined by Tina Bigdelli from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, or NCMEC, to talk about child sex trafficking. Tina, why don't you start by introducing yourself and NCMEC?
Yeah, so my name is Tina Bigdelli. I am a program manager within the outreach training and prevention team at the National Center. I've been here over 5 years, almost 5.5 years. And prior to this, I actually came from the anti-trafficking space. Really, my dream job after I got my master's in social work was to do prevention work, and I wanted to work with youth. And so I got a chance to do that in the DC and Maryland area. I ran a trafficking prevention program, and I did that for several years. So I was working directly with adolescents, so with middle and high school students, some young adults. I was going into schools, detention centers, after-school programs, really anywhere where folks would let me come and talk to their youth. And we talked about trafficking, but that wasn't like, the goal was to prevent trafficking from happening. So we were talking about all of these other issues and all of these other situations that can lead to a trafficking situation. So it was an amazing experience. I learned so much, so much from the young people that I got to interact with and work with. And many of them trusted me and my team and like shared a lot of what they were experiencing. We were able to connect them with resources and supports in the community. So that was really impactful. And after that, I worked in adult literacy for a little bit, a project in Los Angeles. Yeah. I need a little bit of a break from the anti-trafficking space. And then once I was ready to come back, you know, NCMEC was kind of a great next step because of the work they were doing, not just in trafficking, but also other issues that can lead to trafficking and child abuse and maltreatment. So it was a way for me to do similar work as I was doing on the East Coast, but more on a national scale.
I really appreciate the emphasis on prevention work. Prevention is, of course, about addressing a crisis before it happens. So it has become a much larger component of our organization's work. And I'm sure you can say the same for NCMEC. For those who aren't familiar with the organization, can you share a little bit about NCMEC's mission?
Yeah, so we're a national nonprofit organization. We're headquartered in Alexandria, Virginia, but we have offices in New York, Florida, and Texas. I'm based out of LA, so I'm remote and I just travel a lot. It's really what my role is. But our mission is to find missing children, reduce sexual exploitation, and prevent victimization. And so we do that in a few different ways. On the missing side, if a child goes missing, then their legal guardian, so be it a biological family member or their child welfare agency, or the law enforcement agency handling the case can report them missing to us. And then we liaise and kind of coordinate with the family, the caregivers, and the law enforcement agency handling it. We have a lot of case resources to support the investigation, but then we also have a lot of resources for families to support them while they're in the middle of a missing incident, but then also to assist with recovery and kind of long-term healing. The majority of the cases that we see, a majority of reports that we see of missing children are actually children who have run away. It's over 90% of the reports that we see at NCMEC. And so a lot of people are kind of shocked when they hear that because most people think of stranger danger, getting snatched on the street. And interestingly enough, that's kind of how we were founded, was because of some of those high profile cases. But the reality of what we see every single day is most children are missing because they've run away and they're either running from something or to something, or the next kind of highest categories, it's a family abduction. So it's a family member that's taken the child. Those stranger abductions are less than 1% of what we see at NCPIC. On the exploitation side, we operate the National Cyber Tip Line, which is a national reporting mechanism for anyone to make a report of any kind of suspected child sexual exploitation. So that includes trafficking, that includes child sexual abuse materials, which used to be commonly referred to as child pornography, but we don't use that language anymore. It includes sextortion and online enticement. So anyone can make those reports. We get a lot of reports. The bulk of them are actually from what we call electronic service providers. Those are essentially like social media companies, online platforms. If they're US-based, they're federally mandated to report to NCMEC. In 2021, I don't have the final 2022 numbers yet, but in 2021, we received over 29 million reports of suspected child sexual exploitation. Yeah, whoa. It's a lot.
That's a lot.
And every single report is reviewed by an analyst on our team, and then they add value to it. So they just try to find as much information as possible that's publicly available. And then that is shared with law enforcement. So every state, if it's a domestic case, every state within the U.S. has at least one Internet Crimes Against Children task force, which is a true task, like federal and local task force. And then they'll review those reports, and then they'll decide which ones to move forward with in terms of investigation. And then we also serve as like a clearinghouse as well. So we continue to support them and provide case resources and analytical resources. And then they let us know if they're able to identify victims, and we're able to get those victims connected with additional supports for the victim itself and for their families. So that's on the exploitation side. And then the other piece of our mission is prevention. We don't want these bad things to happen in the first place to kids. And so we have all of this data, all of this information because of the different types of cases that we work. And we've developed several prevention programs. Our flagship program is our Internet Safety Program. It's called NetSmarts. And we have content for students like in kindergarten all the way through 12th grade, as well as a family caregiver community component. And it's designed to be very low barrier. It's totally free. There's different pieces. So there's presentations that can be used. There's videos, discussion guides, activities, lots of different resources that can be folded into lots of different types of programs. And then trafficking kind of sits at that intersection of the missing and exploitation programming that we have. We have a hybrid team. They're case managers from our missing side that work these cases, and analysts that are trained up like on our exploitation side. And so they work together. So if a case is ever flagged as trafficking, whether it's a missing child that's been a child that's been reported missing to us, that's been screened in as possible trafficking, or a trafficking report through the cyber tip line, that gets assigned to the specialized chain.
You brought up something that I noticed while planning for our conversation, which is the shift away from the term child pornography and towards the term child sexual abuse material. Why is changing the language here so important?
Yeah, because language really makes a difference on a lot of different levels. It impacts the way victims are viewed and how society views it. So the term pornography, often when we think of that, we think of consensual sex work. And although an adult can consent to engaging in pornography, a minor cannot. So if somebody's 17 and under, they can't legally consent. And the reality is that this is child sexual abuse. It's just child sexual abuse that's facilitated by technology and the internet. And now it's on a different level. And the impact on victims is different than hands-on abuse if there wasn't a video or a photo involved. Already that person has experienced that trauma. And in addition to that, they also have to walk through the world wondering who else has seen that incredibly traumatic experience and that abuse. So we're really, really intentional about the language we use to talk about it and about all of our issues, because we want to make sure that we're calling it what it is and that we're making sure that we're not minimizing the experience in the crime.
Have there always been intersections between child sex trafficking and child sexual abuse material? And has the explosion of social media strengthened those intersections at all?
Yeah, I mean, there was always intersections, right? Even before you could easily like record or take a picture on your phone or using your computer, people were still using camcorders and taking pictures just with a camera that wasn't connected to the internet. And so the intersection really sits where, so let me actually backtrack. I'm sure most of your listeners know this, but I always like to kind of reiterate that child sex trafficking is basically when someone who's 17 or under is engaging in commercial sex. And the commercial sex is the exchange of something of value for a sex act. And so if there's something of value being exchanged, so that video or that photo is being traded at, in any way, if the child was offered something in exchange for engaging on camera, engaging a sexual act on camera, then that would, now we're like veering into trafficking category. If it's some kind of, there's some kind of paywall, anything like that.
My partner works in marketing and advertising, and there was this huge controversy, I remember, about really disturbing conversations happening in the comments section of YouTube videos. And these are videos that feature young kids doing athletic things like gymnastics and things of that nature. Do you also see people leaving tips about things like that, where there's not necessarily like images or videos, but just really alarming conversations that are being had by large groups of people online?
Yeah, so we get a wide range of what we call public reports. So those reports that just regular everyday people make. And I can't speak to kind of the breakdown. I don't know off the top of my head, like what percentage of them are like somebody observed a conversation versus they saw an image and that's what they're reporting. And we also get a wide range when it comes to the providers reporting directly to us. I will say it's when you think about it, you know, you connect with people that have similar interests. And so you're going to be hanging out on the same spaces. And some of those spaces are chat forums, right? Or just chats underneath a video or an image. And that's how they meet, what perpetrators can meet one another. That's how buyers exploit another, you know, exploiter in this situation can get connected with a young person or with a trafficker. So that's kind of how everybody can connect and meet.
I'm curious, do you ever see reports coming from young people themselves?
Yeah, we do actually. And we've been making a very intentional push, I would say, in the last few years, where we're really trying to do outreach to young people directly, like outside of our prevention programs. On our prevention side, you know, there's groups that are run with youth, and we're always pushing the cyber tip line, making reports there, but through social media. So now we're trying to use these tools like TikTok, for example, to reach more young people, to let them know that we're here for them and that it's not their fault if they're in this situation and that we want to help them. And that we will do everything that we can to support and help them through this situation. Yeah. So we do hear from them, and it's really exciting when we hear about how they're hearing about us and how they are courageous enough to reach out, because it can be really scary. And we also understand that somebody may not feel comfortable. So we've developed some new tools and resources for those young people as well. So we actually just launched a new site. It's called Take It Down. And it's a tool where a young person who is concerned that a sexual image or video is online or might pop up online, they can go to the site, they can select the image or video. We never upload the image or video. What we do is we take the digital fingerprint of it, which is called a hash value. That's what we take from it. And then we share that with the social media companies and industry partners who've agreed to participate. And then if it pops up on their sites, then it gets flagged right away, and then it'll get reviewed and taken down. Yeah, and it's totally anonymous. So it's a way for them to be proactive and get in front of it without having to talk to us. Now, we still want them to report to the cyber tip line, because we can connect them with lots more resources and potentially stop a perpetrator from hurting other people, right? But this is a low barrier tool that that young person who may not have felt comfortable reporting cyber tip line can still get in front of this image or video that that they're concerned about circulating online.
Wow, that's actually really incredible. I mean, this type of tool has been available for a while. Record labels use it to automatically identify when the mm-hmm. song that they own has been published, pretty much anywhere. And the same thing can be done with images or videos that are copyrighted. It's great to see that this type of software is being used to help like people instead of businesses.
These websites have a legal obligation to take it down if it's a minor that's involved. And so that's where there's been the challenges and like, how do you prove that this person is a minor without having to, so they're, we've made it really easy. They just answer three really easy questions. And so they themselves will self-identify as a minor in the image or video. But if they are an adult, we also have a link to a similar website for adults who have been in this situation as well.
Wow. What's wild about the way social media works today is that you're essentially fed the same content of the people you follow, and sometimes even the people that they follow. Mm-hmm. If you follow someone that's also using that account to engage with or even just view child sexual abuse material, there's a small chance that that material appears on your own screen. Should people be afraid of that digital trace appearing on their own account, especially considering like a truly concerned person probably isn't going to verify themselves that it is in fact a child sexual abuse material?
It's still, well, if you report it to the platform, that should also generate, then the platform should report to us. So we always recommend you report directly to the platform and to us, because then now we're working on both sides. You don't have to be sure that it's a child. It doesn't matter. All you have to do is suspect that it's a child, report that to us, and then our analysts will do all the digging. So they're the ones who, and everything is open source information, but they're just really good at it. So I, the example I always give is, you know, when you're at work and you just want to take that like 5 minute brain break and you go on social media, and then 30 minutes later, you're looking at like your high school friends, cousins, significant others, somebody's profile, and you're like, how did I get here? This is what our analysts do, but they do it with intention and they're really, really good at it. And so they will do the digging and they'll find as much information as they can. And then they'll pass that on to law enforcement, and then law enforcement will actually, you know, take the steps that they need to take. But it helps get the ball rolling. So at least it can be flagged on that platform's site. And if it is a child, to get it taken down. And NCMEC is pretty quick. If we can identify that, we've got, we really work hard on our relationships with these platforms so we can reach out to them directly. So if a child self-reports themselves, then we can usually get that content taken down pretty quickly. I can't, you know, give legal advice, but what I will say is that if you are proactively reporting suspected child sexual exploitation or abuse, you are taking a step to help a child that's, you know, being exploited and abused. And when we get those reports, we send them to specialized teams that they specialize in investigating these crimes. And so they are looking to get this content taken down and to make sure that victims are supported and that and to stop this from continuing to spread. So I also can't give legal advice. I can't guarantee. And I always say I'm very upfront when someone makes a cyber tip line report, you know, it's always shared with law enforcement. Now what they do with it is out of our control, but I will say we're sending it to specially trained agencies that this is what they do all day. And they genuinely care about protecting children. And that's what their goal is.
I want to pivot a little bit to another thing you mentioned earlier, which is family abductions. How mm-hmm. do you define a family abduction? And what is the line that has to be crossed before a family abduction is considered to be human trafficking?
So a family abduction just means that it's a family member who doesn't have custody of the child that's taken the child. And we see this a lot with biological parents, sometimes grandparents. But it's a biological family member that's taking the child. Now, when there's trafficking happening within the family, so I guess I want to kind of backtrack. I want to dispel like one myth that is often associated with trafficking. And that's that there has to be some type of abduction or some type of movement. And there's no movement actually required for trafficking. And what we often see with what we call familial trafficking is that there isn't any movement. It's just happening in the home like other forms of child abuse and child sex abuse. And similar to the hands-on child sex abuse that many of us are more familiar with, it's challenging to identify because in addition to just the very normal feelings that every child has if they're experiencing abuse is around like shame and embarrassment around it, there's also the added layers of wanting to protect your family, not wanting to get them in trouble. So that makes it even more challenging for a child to disclose. And for those of us on the outside to see it, if there's no physical bruises, right? Now, there could be an abduction that's happening and there could be trafficking also happening. Again, really what makes it a trafficking situation is if there is an exchange of something of value for that sexual abuse, essentially.
Now we're wrapping up Human Trafficking Prevention Month, and I'm so appreciative, particularly to you guys at NCMEC and Polaris, for making it so easy for us to help spread awareness and do the prevention side of the work. What have been some of your own key takeaways from the organizations who participated in the activities this month?
Yeah, I think one of the things that my colleagues and I were talking about this the other day, we've noticed is there's much more of a unified voice around these issues. And we were really excited with the Twitter chat to see so many organizations participating and also organizations that are not just straight anti-trafficking organizations. That's been really powerful. I think having that united voice, that united front, really all of us understanding and kind of talking about it in a similar way, using shared language, has been really important because I think historically, different organizations, because of where they were coming from in terms of the work that they were doing, were not always super unified. And so I feel like we've really come together and are really trying to address this issue together. And I think we're also seeing a lot more support and collaboration amongst the organizations and also with our law enforcement partners.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And we love seeing, I mean, like it was really great because I reached out to you at NCMEC and I reached out to Polaris and Blue Campaign all at the same time. And all three of you like kind of referenced each other being like, and you also should check in with, and it was really great. Were there any answers from this year's Twitter chat since you mentioned that? That like has stuck with you or that were like really surprising?
I think what stuck with me, and again, I think this speaks to some of like the unified messaging, is that we have to be amplifying survivor voices and their perspectives and their experiences, and they should be involved in our work from the beginning, not as like an afterthought afterwards to give us like the check mark that what we did was good. They should be a part of the process because they have the lived expertise and can inform us and make sure that we're doing this work right and that we're making a positive impact. So including survivors from start to finish. I think also meeting kids where they are. We're starting to see a shift in this savior mentality where we're going to come in and we're going to just swoop them out of this situation and everything's going to be fine and everyone is happy. It's going to be like a Hallmark movie. And that's just not the reality of trauma. That's not how it works. And there was a really big push about meeting that young person where they are and walking alongside them and making sure that they are a part of, they're contributing and they have a say in what their healing looks like, what the resources that they're getting, they're having access to, that we're not just making these decisions for them. And NCMEC does that also through our recovery services program. We work with for kids missing from care who have been flagged as suspected trafficking. We work with that social worker to come up with a customized child-centered recovery plan so that there's at least a starting point for their healing process. But with the understanding and coaching that might have to shift and change depending on what that child needs. A couple other things I did want to highlight also that we just have a huge gap in services for LGBTQ plus youth. And not just on the once they've been identified as, having survived a trafficking situation, but also just making sure that they're supported so that they don't end up in a trafficking situation, that they're, you know, that they are accepted and loved and supported kind of throughout their lives, and that we're preventing other types of abuse from happening to them. Yeah, I think those are kind of like the big pieces.
As someone who identifies as queer, I can't help but appreciate that. I think I mentioned earlier, like, witnessing organizations shift from spreading awareness to actually doing the prevention work. I think one of the biggest differences is that the prevention work kind of allows for these vulnerable communities to be targeted with messaging and tools that resonate with their specific situation. For youth-facing organizations who haven't been able to be involved in, like, Human Trafficking Prevention Month, for instance, can you share some of the resources, especially for those who are looking to take a trauma-informed approach to crisis prevention and providing care?
Yeah, so NCMEC specifically, we offer a lot of different trainings. Everything NCMEC does is totally free. And I would actually say this is part of our prevention umbrella is training for professionals, as well as like community members and resources for kids. And so we have an online training platform called NCMEC Connect, and we have a lot of courses on there. Probably the one I would say to start with is our Intro to Child Sex Trafficking course. It's, again, totally free. Anybody can access it. You have to register. But it's a great foundational course to understand trafficking and, but also trauma, and how that can manifest. And we developed that alongside, survivor consultants. So it wasn't something that we just did on our own. We worked, with them to develop that. We also have, some trainings on there about teaching online safety, because we're seeing, you know, this connection with, you know, which we mentioned earlier, how young people are being targeted online, they're being exploited online, whether it's through trafficking or other types of exploitation. So teaching that very early and having those conversations early on is really important. But many adults, many of us don't know how to do that, right? It's intimidating. The internet is really great, but it's also really scary. How do I even start this conversation? And so we have a couple of trainings. One is called Teaching Online Safety, and the other one is called Best Practices on how to have these conversations with young people and how to make all the connections. We also offer our NetSmarts program. Again, it's totally free and it's very easy to incorporate into existing programming. And one of the things that we offer for community-based organizations that are youth-facing or that are already doing some type of prevention or education work with youth is our Community Education Partnership Program. And so what it is it just has to be a nonprofit organization that is working with youth, and they are interested in implementing some sort of internet safety programming. And what we do is we'll train them up on all the NetSmarts resources and walk them through each of the presentations and the other resources we have, talk through how do you talk about these issues? How do you connect it? How do you discuss internet safety when you're talking about healthy relationships and sexuality and other pertinent issues that are all interrelated? And in turn, they just tell us how many kids and adults they're reaching in their programming. And we just provide kind of ongoing technical assistance and support. So it's a great way for them to be proactive in engaging in a program that's totally free, but get kind of some extra help in doing it. And then I always push, you know, in order to be a trauma-informed organization, it's not just about how you engage with the youth. It's also how you're treating your staff and how you're supporting your staff. Because if your staff are not, you know, feeling supported and healthy and able to work through their own triggers, because we're triggered by the young people we work with all the time, right? Like our own stuff comes up, then it's hard for us to be kind of that stable supporting space. So I really always push for that as well.
I love that. It's so important to provide training for organizations like ours and police departments, but it's equally important, in my opinion, to have training that's accessible and digestible for people who are unfamiliar with youth-facing nonprofit organizations. Are there any other ways that someone who isn't familiar with this type of work can get involved?
Yeah. So I usually talk about this kind of in a few different levels. First, try to learn as much as you can from it. Look at, you know, reputable organizations that are doing this work, like NRS, like Polaris, like NCMEC. Just try to read up and learn as much as you can, and take as many free trainings as you can. That's how I got into this. I started going and just signing up for free in-person and online trainings. And that's how, you know, my passion was kind of ignited and I got really into it. So that's what I would start with, just to inform yourself about what this really looks like and to be able to dispel the myths that we often see perpetrated kind of through the media and folks like to talk about the most. And then I would say start with the children in your life. So whether they're in your household, they're your friends' kids, your nieces, nephews, you work at a school, anywhere you have access to kids, being that stable, caring adult that is opening up the lines of communication, having conversations with them about how they can, about the risks that are there, how they can stay safer. You don't necessarily need to even start talking about trafficking right away. It's talking about how do you stay safe when you're playing Roblox on your tablet? You know, what's a healthy relationship? And that starts with friendships. You know, how do you know that your friendship is healthy? Like, how should you treat somebody else? If somebody says that they don't want a hug, you know, how should you deal with that rejection? And so it's like really basic foundational conversations to be having. And then I would say the next step is get involved in a mentorship program, work with youth in your community, that maybe don't have those trusted adults readily available and be that trusted adult for them. I mean, that is really, if you want to talk about real prevention, that's what that is. It's not waiting until the trafficking thing situation has happened. That's when the bad, bad thing has already happened.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you just blew my mind a second ago. It's just, I'm from the South and like the whole, like, I'm going to hug you thing. It's like a huge invasion of privacy and I've struggled with that for such a long time. And the thought of that being like an area where like, it's important to educate your child on how to say no to those things and how to set those type of boundaries. It's like, I never even thought about that being a way for to just get people to understand that they have autonomy over what happens to them and the way that people treat them. So thank you for sharing that.
And being that example, my family is of Iranian descent and we are like, there is a standard practice. When you enter a family party, you give everybody, not just a hug, but you give them a kiss, like every single person, even if you don't know them. And we've had to have a lot of conversations in my family around, we're not going to make our kids do that. Like, we're just not. And then I have to also practice that. When I see my nephew, I am obsessed with him. I just want to squeeze him and smother him with kisses. But if he says no, or if he does, I ask him if it's okay. And if he says no, then I have to control myself. I'm the adult. So I have to show that I have the ability to control myself and to respect what he wants or needs. And then if later on he changes his mind, great. And if he doesn't, then that's also okay. It's his body. So we can also practice what we're trying to teach other people. It's not fair for me to tell a kid you can say no, but then I don't actually, you know, respect that and give them the opportunity to say no.
That's so incredibly powerful. Is there one thing in particular that you really want people to take away from our conversation today?
I think that one of the things that I often get frustrated about when people want to talk about trafficking in particular and how bad this is that they don't want to acknowledge or talk about the other issues that intersect and create the space for this to happen, like racism, like systemic racism, like housing instability, like, you know, issues with our education system and our healthcare system and all of these other societal issues that if they were solved, I feel very confident that trafficking would not be what it is today. Because what's happening is we're creating unstable environments for young people where they're not getting their needs met. And the adults in their lives are preoccupied with trying to take care of them and get those basic needs met. And so it causes this spiral effect. So when people want to talk about trafficking, I'm like, let's talk about systemic racism. I'm like, let's talk about our education system. So that's often where my conversations go. And that I do feel like I have to just put that out there, that these systems are contributing to this problem and we have to solve those issues. Now, those seem like very big issues and they're kind of scary. And how can the average person address them? And I don't know that this is the right conversation for that. But I would say then, you know, on the other side of it is, if you really want to stop this from happening in your community, be an active member of your community, be active in the lives of children, be that trusted person they can go to and listen to them, believe them, don't try to tell them what to do. be that safe person, because you never know what they're going to tell you and they're going to share with you if you give them that opportunity. NCMEC is here. If you suspect trafficking, if you suspect exploitation of a child, please report it to us. Please let us know. Cybertipline.org, or you can go to our website, missingkids.org. We are going to be changing our website to NCMEC.org. So if you just Google NCMEC, you'll be able to find us. But you can make a report there. The Take It Down site is also linked on our website. That's a resource. And really take advantage of our prevention programs. If you're interested in engaging in prevention and you don't know how to start, please reach out to us. You can email outreach@ncmec.org. So outreach@ncmec.org. And my team, we love connecting with folks in the community and, you know, providing guidance on how we can collaborate and engage in protecting children together.
Tina, this has been so outstanding. Thank you so much. And a major thank you to everyone tuning in. Don't forget, this is part 2 of 3 on our human trafficking series. Part 1 is available at 1-800-runaway.org/podcast or anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. Be on the lookout for part 3, where I'll be joined by Corinda L. Washington, the Executive Director of Social Impact and Campaigns over at Blue Campaign. See you next time.